Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The War Room, the interview series brought to you as part of the Clone Star Pod. I'm your host, Mike Overton, and my guest this week is an incredible visual effects artist, digital artist, and FUI designer. He's worked on some incredible projects such as Independence Day Resurgence, Fast and the Furious Hobbs and Shaw, an incredible TV show called The First, and a really tiny project that no one's ever heard of before called Star Trek Picard. My guest this week is the incredible Andrew Jarvis. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
So, do you want to just give us a little bit of an overview of what it is that you actually do? Because I don't think a lot of people will understand what an FUI designer is and what that kind of entails.
Yeah, so FUI stands for Fictional User Interface Designer. The F can swap out for other things like fantasy or futuristic, but basically doing fictional user interfaces for film or television has been my job for the last decade or so. It's a lot of fun. The previous decade, first 10 years of my career was as a web developer. So I was doing real world interfaces. And then it was around 2015, I started at Twisted Media, where it was all basically exercising the same skill set, except instead of real world interfaces, I was doing fictional ones for films that they would play back on set. And even simple things like, you know, social media apps or the kind of applications that you'd use just working, you can't use those on film because they wouldn't be legally clearable to just show, you know, somebody's software without getting the rights to it. So they use people like us to create legally clearable versions of those software. So a lot of it's not very glamorous, right? If you see somebody, you know, scrolling their phone on TV, somebody like me had to design that. And so you put your, you know, you pay your dues, and then eventually you get to do the cool shit, like making stuff for Star Trek and doing glowing holograms in sci-fi movies, which is certainly the fun part. So you got to pay your dues with boring stuff too.
Exactly. So, okay. So you started off as a user interface designer, a web developer.
Exactly.
How do you then translate that into futuristic or fantasy UI? I'm guessing a lot of the fundamentals are still the same, or because I mean, me myself, I'm also a web designer and a web developer. So that's my day job. So yeah. How do you go from that to then designing these futuristic interfaces? Do you still have to follow the same rule book, or do you just put that out the window and just make something that looks cool?
Well, it was really the convergence of a couple skill sets, right? Like, because I'd already been sort of moving in that direction of doing motion graphics while I was doing web development. And so you kind of have to have a lot of the toolkit of like a visual effects artist to begin with.
Yeah.
But having that real world UI experience is super important too. Because you want to create something that is visually interesting. Directors, for the most part, obviously, number one, they care about the storytelling. And then two, like your job is half storytelling and then half set deck, right? And so you want, if you're doing a bunch of ND screens, which is our term for nondescript screens, right? Then that's set decoration, right?
Okay.
And that's half of your job, is just making stuff that looks cool. And then the other half is when you're called upon to tell a part of the story, and that's called a hero screen, right? So anytime the script, basically anytime part of the story is being told on your screen, that is now elevated to a hero screen. And now all of those background screens, nobody cares about those. And a whole village of people is sitting there while a camera is pointed at your graphic, which can be very, very stressful.
Very cool at the same time.
Well, very, you know, yeah, very cool, but very high stakes, because if there's something wrong or the director wasn't able to review the work in time and says, oh, there's a last minute change, we need, you know, or they change the blocking. They said, you know what, we were going to shoot it this way on the iPad, but actually the shot works better if we face it this way. So we need to put it on an Android or, you know, or a totally different shaped screen. So you need to very quickly redesign it to play on that new device, which can be, it can be stressful at times.
I can imagine. So it's kind of really broken down then into two camps, as it were. Yeah. One which is your background stuff, and then which is your hero stuff.
And that's all playback, right?
Right.
And so then the other way you can split in half is stuff that shoots during production, and then the stuff that's added in post.
So, for example, then stuff in post would be a lot of the season one in Picard stuff with the holographic display. So they would be the stuff that would be done in post. Whereas I'm guessing a lot of the background stuff would be like auxiliary bridge displays on the Stargazer and on the Titan. Mm-hmm. And then what would a hero be? Would that be, I don't know, maybe when in season three, you know, they're sitting at the museum, they're scrolling through the ships on, so that close-up screen Seven uses, would be a hero screen.
Exactly. And that has an ND version, right? Like the nondescript version of that screen is playing back every day, all day, whenever they're shooting in that bridge. There's sort of a default loop that we've created that is just a movie loop that's playing on that iPad.
Yeah.
But then they say, okay, on this, you know, episode scene, she's going to be scrolling on this particular pad. And so we need to rig it to respond to hand movement. So that's actually using Twisted Media's proprietary playback system so that you can actually have interaction on set.
We're going to talk more about Star Trek in a little bit, but I just kind of want to go through some of your previous work. So Independence Day Resurgence, that looks like it was one of your first kind of entrances into this. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, I had worked on a pilot for a show called Second Chance, which I love it. It's like the, you know, they're just constantly riffing on the police procedural.
Yep.
And this was the Frankenstein where this cop had died and then he was brought back to life. And you know, I don't think it got very, I think it got like four episodes. But yeah, I worked on
can't imagine why.
Second Chance. Yeah, Frankenstein the cop the show. And then the very next thing was this huge, a sequel to Independence Day. And I'm like, what is happening? Like a month earlier, I was a web designer, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was like, okay, I guess this is happening. Chris Kiefer was working with me on that project. He had already been working on it before I was hired and had set the tone for Area 51. And he had done like one screen in the Area 51 look and it got approved. The director liked it. And then it was my job to basically fill dozens upon dozens of screens in that look. And so it was a really hard, fast crash course in what it means to be an FUI designer. Like I just started to churn out screens for that. And it was a lot of fun. I was using all these After Effects plugins and I was learning. I already knew After Effects 2015, I knew After Effects like, and by the end of that movie,
moment.
I knew it really well. Just so many hours. And then, yeah, after Area 51, then it was like, oh, so many. And then we started delivering. So that was all playback. And then cut to like a few months later, and we're delivering graphics for post-production. And so I sort of got to see the playback side of it and that.
Yep.
How that works, and I was lucky enough to get to visit the set. I saw Brent Spiner. Had no idea I'd be making graphics for him later as well. And then seeing the visual effects side and delivering graphics to post or delivering graphics to visual effects to composite, and so that it was just a huge craft course in the whole movie making process.
So you wrap up Resurgence and then you move on to some other projects. So there's two Godzilla movies in there. You got Godzilla versus Kong and Godzilla King of the Monsters.
So yeah, absolutely. Chris Kiefer was the lead on both of those projects, worked with the whole team at Twisted, Clark, Tom, Noah, had a lot of fun on those, but we didn't get to do a lot of the look dev on those, right? Because on shows that big, Legendary Films. Like, they've got like five companies working on the graphics for those films. So, you know, me doing my best impression of the previous designer's work, because that's a lot, you know, that's a lot of what collaborating on a film is all about, you know?
So okay, this is a silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I'm guessing it's easier to do something from scratch than it is to just follow the inspiration that's already come from it. So, you know, I'm guessing it's easier to just start from scratch and design something from scratch rather than fill in the gaps.
Well, I wouldn't say it's easier. I think copying is easier, but it's not as fun, right? And so if I had my druthers, I'd rather work on something where I could participate in the initial look dev process.
Gotcha.
It's not easier. It's harder, but it's definitely preferable because you know, you actually get to, you know, express creativity.
Okay. So then after that, it's, you kind of move on to is it Fast and the Furious, Hobbs and Shaw next?
Well, you know, we're cutting out. I mean, there's so many shows, you know, I do a little here, a little there. Like we were, Twisted Media still has its hand in many pies of, you know, all the Chicago shows, Chicago Med, Chicago Fire, and, you know, that kind of thing. I got to do some like dance graphics behind people in Empire, right, during their musical routine. So stuff you'd never think of.
And then you get phoned up to work on a really small time project called Star Trek Picard. So how did that come about?
Well, so season one, I worked at Twisted Media. So that came in and they said, who's a Star Trek fan? And I'm like, I mean, I've been a fan all my life. And here, I'll show you that this poster, pun, this is Chris Cushman's Enterprise D cutaway graphic. That pun on my childhood bedroom wall, and I've now had it professionally framed to hang in my office. As soon as the opportunity to work on an actual Star Trek production, it didn't have a name at the time, you know, but they said there's this, and actually the very first, part of this I'm really talking about is Star Trek Discovery. The first time we got a message about Star Trek and I had the possibility of working on Star Trek, it was Discovery. And so we had been asked to prepare some examples, and boy, you know, I had so much fun just creating all sorts of graphics for that, put together a little like mini show reel of just of our pitch, you know, for what we could do. And then the show ended up going to Canada, and I hired a company in Canada, and we didn't get it. But it definitely sort of sparked me to say, okay, well, if I was a big Star Trek fan before, now there's a real professional interest in becoming as big an expert as I can, because if you're telling me that your job to be Star Trek,
it's the dream that many of us have, isn't it? That is
right.
That is the dream.
I really started boning up. There were a few technical manuals I hadn't gotten yet, so that I used that opportunity to get them. And then I guess it was like 2 years later that it was like, okay, again. Now they're doing Star Trek again. This time we really might work on it. And a lot of the little like pre-animated like GAC modules that I had done for that initial pitch worked their way into La Serena's design. There's a lot of little graphical elements in the Serena that started out as ideas for the, what could have been Star Trek pitch for Discovery. Yeah.
Interesting.
Now let's fast forward 2 years later. Now we really are being asked, all right, we're doing this. We've got the project. We're working on Star Trek Picard. So now it's entirely appropriate to use Alcox. The palette was the one thing I felt like I could bring some kind of upgrade to, right? Like I wanted the overall structure and visual style to be mostly the same. But I thought, okay, if there's one thing I can bring to it is perhaps pretty tight, uniform palette, the gray and the reddish orange. And so I was pleased with that. And then, of course, the iconic shot that everyone remembers from season one. They said, I'll make it blue. So you have that blue version, you know, the one where Picard is using it in his study on the Serena. He's looking up Borg information.
The artifact, treaty, the Borg. Working.
And Lucu just comes Borg in front of him, yep.
I love that shot. And so I said, all right, well, if we can't use the 25th century palette for that, a good fallback, of course, is the blue that we saw on Nemesis, because that was the last time we saw Elkars in the Star Trek timeline, was on the Enterprise E in Star Trek Nemesis. So I wanted to really do my best impersonation of that palette so that there could be some sort of continuity and say, well, Picard's an older guy. Why wouldn't he reskin his interface sort of with the previous design's look?
Yeah. So is that palette slightly more muted compared to what we saw in Nemesis? Because I'm just trying to remember back, it seemed almost teal-esque, that kind of bluey green. But I've recently just rewatched season one and two, so it's still relatively fresh in my head. But it is a different color palette, though, isn't it?
I tried to match it pretty well. I mean, I noticed that on the remaster, they just did a new remaster, and they sort of mess with the colors a bit. And
that's what I'm wondering if
a lot less teal and more blue. And I'm like, oh, great. They just like shifted the color away from the continuity I was trying to maintain. Oh, well.
Because, I mean, they're all 90% of them are all holographic. So they're all, I'm guessing, done in post. Was there much done in the way of live playback, or were they just printed elements? Were they actually? I'm just thinking, if you look at Lassarena's bridge, you've got the two up front consoles. The screens that we see at the front, are they printed, or were they displays? Or
yeah, there weren't a lot of backlit transparencies, but those were some of them, right? Those two big stations in front of the Serena. And I really like those. And so on season one, Serena, those were all translates in front. And then any kind of hero graphics that were done, the performers would wave their hands in front of the air. And then in post, we would add graphics to them, which is a lot more relaxed kind of way to do it. You have a lot more time to get to dial in the look of the graphics. It's an easier process to do versus basically creating like a little video game that needs to play on set in reaction to the actors. That's a lot harder.
You've been given the go ahead for 25th century Elkars. You'd already touched upon that you'd started with this very limited gray, deep orange color palette.
Right. And there was no teal.
No, there was no teal.
There was no teal in that.
Was the color palette your idea, or did that come from Mike Okuda, or was it your idea and then refined? Or because it's my favorite color palette.
Thank you. I liked it a lot too, and it was one of the only things I felt confident about. Right, like there were so many things that I just felt like, you know, I mean, it's a huge responsibility. And especially for someone who loves Star Trek, that just makes it even scarier. So first time you were going to see it was on the Stargazer. And I wanted the Stargazer to kind of feel like an embodiment of Picard himself, right? I wanted it to have a seriousness to it.
Yep.
And also, you know, I think the fans kind of color code the alien races in Star Trek by the colors of their ships, and the Federations were gray. So nobody had done gray Elkars before. I said, why not? If that's the color of the ship and that's sort of how we might color code them in our mind, I thought it was a great option. Through feedback from Dave Blass and Jeffrey Mandel and my internal team, we settled on the season one color palette with the grays and the reddish orange, but we added that teal. It balanced out the palette quite a bit, and it really addressed the, oh, this is too militant look. So I thought that it worked out quite well. And eventually we refined it, I think, even more to really have the visualization be the teal, right? That like the graphic that's behind you, the visualization of the ship would be more of the teal, and then the Elkars controls would be more of that gray and orange.
Yep. No, that makes sense. Okay, so there are some very distinct differences between Stargazer's Elcars and the Titan's Elcars.
Okay. Yeah, also,
I know this because I've recreated many of these screens.
Yeah.
So was that just down to a refinement process? Because I find the Stargazer's UI is a bit more fragmented. It's a lot more open space with elements just kind of aligned with lots of gaps, whereas Titans is a lot more condensed and I'm not going to say busy because that's not, but it's more, I find it more cohesive.
This was Ikuda's involvement, right? So early on, obviously season one, Denise and Michael were not even asked to participate. Maybe they were, but as far as I know, they weren't. Seasons two and three, Dave Blass comes in. He says, I'm getting old guard in. Yep. And so I'm very grateful to Dave to include all of them. But Michael Ikuda, we got some time early on in season two doing the Elcars look dev. And those are just kind of meetings. Like he was still, I think, like eyeballs deep in season three of For All Mankind. So it was really just like showing what we'd done, getting feedback, a little back and forth. But by sort of the end of season two, his time had freed up. And right. He was actually able to roll up his sleeves and start helping out. And so he did a pass at the big science bay that you see featured a lot in season three. And the engineering bay. He did a pass at that. And he created a whole bunch of elements. And we worked them together so that it was actually sort of kind of a mix of elements that both of us had designed. And I certainly don't want to make it sound like, you know, it was just me and Michael Ikuda like
in a dungeon somewhere
all together. No, it was a much larger team. You know, we were running things through. Jeffrey Mandel is credited as the graphic designer for Star Trek Picard. Playback graphics in the structure of the show, that's its own department. The graphics department, of which Jeffrey Mandel was the lead graphic designer, that's all of the non-animated graphics.
Such as that.
Season two, I mean, it was a madhouse, like just trying to keep up with the demands of the show. So there was a lot of late nights with Noah, Casey Felt, and Seth Molson was our third hand that we finally got in season three. You can tell the elements I did were probably a little, I don't know, I'm a little more scattered when it comes to design. I like unstructured design. I think that's why I excel at the alien interfaces, you know, the Romulan stuff, the Borg stuff. It need to be super dense and complicated and feeling like a human can't understand this.
Yep.
I'm good at making those designs versus Elcars, that should feel very and very understandable. And even though there's a lot of information, it should feel like there's a real cohesive design keeping it all together. And so I'm really grateful that Ikuda was able to help with that, because I think the science, looking at the science bay, that's like the perfect combination of our aesthetics, I think. Yep. Like, and it looks a lot, I think, a lot cleaner perhaps than what was on the Stargazer.
Yeah, the science bay is one that I haven't done, so it's definitely one that it's on my list of list of ones to look at some point. But I've got to get La Serena sorted out first. So,
that's oh boy,
anyone that doesn't know, yes, I'm working on some La Serena graphics with the amazing help of Andrew Jarvis here, who's helped me with some hints and tips along the way. But yeah, so. And then obviously there was a lot of work into season three. There's a lot of UI in season three.
Yeah. One and two, it was basically like two people doing it. And then in season three, it was three people.
Yeah, I mean, I can see
a lot of work.
I mean, I think the thing we see more in season two, we get a glimpse, in season three, we get a glimpse of them in season two. And I think they're there for a few shots, but that's those transparent OLED displays that we see on the bridge. But we see a lot more of them in season
three. Which ones exactly? Like, are you talking about the bays, or are you talking about
The stations that are behind the captain's chair, the commander's chair? They are, and also they're at the front of the bridge as well. They are those transparent OLED displays.
Oh, yeah.
We briefly see them in season two, but they're used a lot more. And one of the things that I've noticed, I mean, I'm rewatching season three at the moment. I'm about halfway through of my rewatch. Those graphics are changing 6-7 times an episode. Every time I look at them, there's something different. So I know one of them was displaying half of the Ready Room table, which, of course, I know what it is because I've seen it. But
yeah.
So, I mean, how much of that kind of, I don't want to say cannibalization, but how much of that, obviously, I know the answer to this, but, well, yeah, sure. Other people won't. But how much of that reuse was there of taking sections of a display and just tweaking it because you needed something to fill a gap?
Right. That's always the game, right? Like you go into these shows, and I like to spend that pre-production time, or at least I did back then, would be like creating a little pre-animated GAC elements that I could basically build compositions out of.
Right.
And so all of the elements that I was building them out of were already animated. So it saves a lot of time. Those screens, I remember just like, you know, having like half of a day at the end of a Friday, to just do a few like ND screens. I think that the one that was like half of the Ready Room graphic, that was Noah. Noah did the Ready Room graphic. And I think he put that screen together too. We had video assist on season three, right? Like all through season two, I think it was available, but I didn't have access to it. Season three, I got access to video assist. And what that is they actually allow people to, through like, it's super secure. Like you need to like authenticate it like three different ways. And then you're able to see the production live, and you can actually see through the cameras. I know. And so there was this one version of that transparent OLED screen that I just didn't like. For whatever reason, it was like the worst of the six that we had done for that screen. And I remember just like messaging Andrew Miller or Rick Kahn, or the playback guys on set there, and going, hey, switch that out. I hate that one. use C, don't use B. Don't use B anymore. They've seen
delete
it
B. Just get rid of it. Oh dear. And then of course there's more than just the Titan. There's that you have the shuttlecraft.
Well, sure. Oh. Yeah, and that was 90% Jeffrey Mandel. He had taken elements that I gave him a whole like pack of like a vector pack of all of our 25th century L cars, and then he sort of like kit bashed everything. Right. All those transparent backlit screens, and just the ones in the front, that was the Todd Marks playback, where we were looping.
There's graphics. A couple, and there's a couple behind as well, wasn't there, on those, on the walls behind as well,
right? Yeah usually over your shoulder there's
you see the Starbase, and then I was gonna say, so there's obviously the Titan. So lots going on the Titan. There's lots of printed. There's lots of playback, and then of course there's multiple sets, because obviously on the Stargazer you really only got the bridge and a corridor. So where you've got the nacelle control room. So that has that had playback on it. You've got the transporter room, sick bay. There's that weird bit of corridor outside of where Data was sitting that's got transporter displays on. And so I'm guessing that must have been a mammoth task then for the three of you to kind of essentially reinvent the wheel, because by the look of it, the vast majority of the stuff that was done for season two was replaced. There were obviously elements, but a lot of the UI was fresh. Because, I mean, I'm just trying to think. I mean, other than really the turbo lift graphic was almost identical.
Yeah, turbo lift stayed totally the same. We just swapped out the ship.
But then obviously, you know, there's obviously all the stuff that was on the Titan. Then you've got the Ilios.
Yes, that I love the Ilios, because it's such a great throwback.
Was there much in the way of playback on the Ilios?
Yeah, there totally was, but there was also a lot of great collaboration with like all the old guard from Alan Kobayashi, Jeffrey Mandel. These are people who worked during the Berman era, and just to have them on staff, like I did as little as I could on that, because I said, you know, I want, you know, my hand, my look to be in the 25th century Romulan, 25th century Borg, 21st Century Alcars with Michael Okudin and all of them as well. But for Elios, like, this should look like it just got pulled right from the Berman era. So I don't want to do anything, because I know if I design it, it won't quite look like it's from that era. So yeah, I found some, like, Jeffrey Mandel sent me a vector pack of, like, stuff that he had used back in the day. And so I leaned on that as much as possible. So it really, really is as authentically 21st century as possible.
That, I mean, that was a, I know when we spoke to Liz about that set, it was a very square set. So, I mean, there was, how many playback? There was three screens, I think, or was it?
The front screen was all visual effects. That wasn't real, right? When they look at the view screen, but you had the controls in the front, and then you had, there was like a warp drive status screen behind, and then there was another one that had like a whole diagram of the ship. There were a few.
Okay. Yeah.
And then there was like the pod controls. I remember Noah was trying to get those pod controls just right.
So that's I suppose that's something that I hadn't even considered would be the door controls, because they were all animated, weren't they? And I suppose I didn't even click that. Yes, you would need to do those as well. So of course, then there's the Shrike.
Oh yeah.
So was there how much involvement did you have with the Shrike, or?
Shrike started with Okuda. I know he started playing with, he grabbed like the old Dominion writing, the characters from the Dominion. Although obviously it's kind of a bit of a secret going into it that they're connected with the Dominion. So I think he didn't lean too heavily into making it look just like that, but he included those characters. You see him like the ticking bomb that's using those. That was a collaboration between Okuda and Noah. I didn't touch that bomb at all. And I remember it being a bit of a pain in the ass. So
that was a good thing then.
good job to them getting through that. But yeah, it was one of those things that, with me working on all the Alcars stuff and I don't know what else I was working on at the time, it was one of those things that it kind of seemed like, okay, maybe we don't need Andrew for this. And so Okuda was pumping out designs, and then I remember Jeffrey Mandel did a riff on that. And so it looked like it was in good shape. And then I think like right before it filmed, it was the night before it filmed, it was like, okay, we need this to look more, I don't remember where this is coming from. It might have been Dave, it might have been somebody else, but there was sort of a need for it to just be punchier, right? Be more alien. And I was like, oh boy. And Okuda called me. It was late at night. And I was just like, oh, okay, like heck yeah. Like I'm up to bat now, right? This whole interface that I thought like it was kind of gonna be like the one interface in the show I didn't touch. And then I spent all night on it. And I remember that, like, that night I did not go to bed. Like I was up, like when my coworkers started to come online that morning, I was like, okay, here you go. And
I'm going to bed now.
I had, well, no, I wish. Now it's time to start filming. Now I'm really up to like actually respond to set requests. I just gave it a little more fluidity, and I create a whole bunch of little animated widgets that would kind of just animate along the paths and have things sort of morph a little bit. A lot of the stuff you see in like the Romulan interface, like I want things to be like sort of weirdly morphing and moving. And so I spent all night on that so that it would have that kind of punch to address that note of being a little more organic, a little more weird and alien-y. And I made like two. I think I was like, okay, here's the new Shrike look. And I hear two screens that exemplify it, right? We're going to have one on one side, one on the other. So there's that look like down the barrel of the Shrike ship. And you've got like the screens there and the screens there. And that was the only time you saw them. Then when they did an insert shot, and I was like, well, and then just use the backlit transparency version. And that's, I think, Jeffrey Mandel's version. And hey, I'm glad for Jeffrey's version to get more time. I'm certainly happy with that. But it was kind of one of those deals where, and you get used to this in this job, yeah, where you'll put hours and hours and hours into something and it just won't get in the final shot. Like, that's fine.
You know? But does that, I mean, that must be a little bit heartbreaking knowing that you essentially did 12 hours overnight putting these things together and for them to literally be on screen for a few seconds.
You start out going, that thing's been 12 hours, didn't get in. But, you know, a lot of the ones did. I've just had such a generous slice of the Star Trek pie. You know, like, what fan could say, like, oh, all of these designs that I've done have been used in Star Trek. So, you know, you can't complain.
No, exactly. Well, okay, we're gonna look to wrap things up because you have been incredibly generous with your time. So we always end our podcast episodes with a really easy question, takes no thinking at all.
There we go.
Patrick Jarvis, what does Star Trek mean to you?
I think that was sarcasm, wasn't it? Right. Star Trek is a hopeful vision of the future. It is a vision of the future where compassion and reason are chosen over our prejudices and our hatreds. You know, I think it's choosing love over hate and hopefully projecting that course of human history. You know, if you choose love over hate, here's what could happen. Okuda says that For All Mankind is sort of an example of how humanity might get to the stars, right? But I think ultimately humanity has a brighter future if we're able to celebrate our differences. And, you know, that was sort of Roddenberry's mission statement from the beginning, having diverse people, you know, putting a Russian on the bridge, you know, during the Cold War and stuff like that. I think that's what it means to me. Ultimately, though, I think what attracted it to me as a child was that it was such a cohesive universe that you believed it existed beyond just what you saw on the show, right? Like, that off camera, you believed there was a whole ship that you weren't seeing because you had these technical manuals and you had, you know, such consistency between the different incarnations, and that always excited me. But I think, what it means to me, that's a tough one. Hopefully I gave you a good answer.
No, that's perfect. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm currently working with the Roddenberry Archive, where they are, I can't go into any detail whatsoever, but they're recreating things from Star Trek's history. And if that's vague enough for you.
That's definitely vague, but it sounds incredibly awesome. And I really can't wait to see what that entails. If people want to reach out to you, where is the best place to get a hold of you?
I feel like Twitter's unfriendly now, right? But my Instagram handle is andrewjarvis.art. Or if you look on my website, ion.studio.
Awesome. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time. This has been an incredible pleasure for me. You know, as a massive fan of your work, has been incredible. So I thank you so much. To everyone who's been listening and watching, thank you for joining us, and we will catch you with the next episode. Live long and prosper. Thank you.